Chapter 36. To Whom It May Concern. A breeze lazed over a sheltered cove, bragging of the places it had been. It held the scent of spices from Feru Maru, and the silks and gold of Kesh. Traces of Akkadian ale and Tikalish black powder mixed in among even subtler aromas of wheat fields and wild flowers. A bloodhound might have picked out such nuance, but to the sailors of the fair trader, it stank of nothing but fish and salt. The cove was little more than a divot in a misshapen piece of rock that jutted into the Katamic. It was unnamed and marked on maps only as a hazard. Its barren crags were too steep even to land a boat on. Its only redeeming features were shelter from view on three sides, and a draft deep enough to anchor safely. Denric Zane stood on the quarterdeck, hands clasped behind his back, staring out over the Katamic. It was their third and last day of waiting. Before the sun set and made the leaving treacherous, they would be on their way once more, to stalk the trade lanes and take their plunder where they found it. Come the first of Hearthwatch, they would take respite in another hideaway, enact repairs, and wait once more for the Merciful to find them. Denric's days passed slowly of late, but his nights were gone in the closing of his eyes and the opening of them again. Sleep took him, and it seemed morning came instantly. He had not been aware of Jinzan for a long while, neither seeing his exploits nor remembering them after the fact. Last he remembered, he was sitting in a dank, moldy crypt, reading volumes on necromancy left by Lorimar. After that, things grew hazy, then non-existent. "Ship on the horizon," the lookout called down from the crow's nest. Denric's eyes had grown old. Though he stared out at that same horizon, he saw nothing, nor did he acknowledge the lookout. The sky was like an overfilled tankard, a tarnished pewter gray, likely to spill at any moment. Denric wondered which would arrive first, the ship or the storm. "Mr. Holyoke, prepare one of the guns. Fire a shot," Denric ordered.
"Aye, Cap'n,"
Holyoke replied smartly. Denric heard his mate disappear below decks and start bellowing orders of his own.
"Kathoom!"
Denric felt the familiar old jolt through the decks as the cannon fired. On even the best of days, only the sharpest and luckiest of eyes catch sight of a cannonball in flight. Denric saw nothing of their shot until it splashed in the water, well clear of the approaching vessel. Denric waited.
"Kathoom, kathoom, kathoom, kathoom."
By the sound, every gun on the approaching ship had fired at once. Denric smiled, the first genuine smile he could recall since... he could not recall that either. He shook his head at his friend Stalyart's wasteful and dramatic style. When the Merciful finally pulled alongside the fair trader, Stalyart was the first across, leaping the gap between ships before the gangplanks had even been laid across.
"Captain Zane!"
Stalyart exclaimed, loud enough that the crews of both ships could hear.
"We have the best news for you."
He swept his arms to the deck of his ship, and Denric saw a slip of a boy standing among the ruffians. He was the very image of Anzac, allowing for a shorter cut of hair and a gallon or so less meat on him.
"His name?" Denric muttered through closed lips.
"Jaden, Captain,"
Stalyart replied, leaning close.
"Welcome aboard, Jaden,"
Denric called across to his son. The boy said nothing, which gave Denric not the least cause for surprise. Jaden seemed to understand, at least, what was expected of him. He stood at the end of the gangplank, peering down into the dark waters below.
"Come on," a grating voice interjected. "I've got you."
Tanner scooped the boy up and set him on a shoulder. He crossed the gangplank with Jaden riding a hero's salute. Crews from both ships cheered. Tanner slid the boy down from his shoulder right in front of Denric.
"Hello, father,"
Jaden said, looking up at him with a neutral expression. It was an improvement over the utterly blank one he was accustomed to seeing on Anzac's face.
"You know who I am, then?" Denric asked.
He gave the boy a shrewd look. A child twinborn was an iffy thing. He needed to know how well the boy understood what the worlds really were.
"Of course, Counselor," Jaden said. "Sorry, Captain, I mean."
The boy gave him a wink that looked like he had caught a fly in his eye. "Let us adjourn to my cabin," Denric said quietly. To the rest of the crew, he shouted, "Break out the rum!" A cheer went up from both ships, and the four of them slipped quietly to the captain's quarters. The door closed behind them. "Mr. Tanner," Denric said, "you have far exceeded my dismal expectations of you."
"This mean you're going to make good?" Tanner asked.
"Of course. A pirate's word needs to carry weight. Then again, we never agreed on a price."
"Tanner was most helpful," Stalyard vouched. "We could not have been successful without his clever plans."
"How clever were they?" Denric asked. He pulled a chair out and got Jaden to sit in it.
"I had Anzik help us out," Tanner replied. "He was a spy right with him. My folk, the rotter of a magician and my best lad, weren't talking about it Vaedra's side. I went sideways round him."
Tanner leaned his chair back against the wall and smirked. "What became of the kidnappers?" Tanner's smirk dissolved.
"Ain't no more, at least on this side."
"We had intended to spare the life of Tanner's friend, but our rescue became a test of swords in the dark," Stalyard said, hands spread wide. "I prevailed. The magician used real magic to disappear, but Tanner saw his footprints in the snow and shot him as he ran."
"Snow? How far north had you gone?" Denric asked.
"Hey, time for tales later," Tanner interrupted. "I know what I want for payment."
Denric set his jaw, prepared to hear whatever outrageous demand the coinblade made before deciding to gut him and toss him overboard.
"I want a ship," Tanner said, "and a crew."
Denric burst out laughing. "After all your belly aching, you have decided to go into piracy after all?"
"Nah, I don't want a fancy ship like this. I want something built for cargo," Tanner explained. "And I want that ship off limits to you and any pirate who pays his tributes to you."
"I think I've about worn out the coinblade path.
The grass is gone and the ruts are about knee deep. I've got coin enough now, I think, that it's cheaper buying more coin than it is working for it."
"Ha!" Denric replied. "You, a merchant."
Tanner nodded.
"Deal,"
Denric said. "I have nothing on hand right now, but we'll find you a ship and a crew fit for her. You can remain aboard until then."
"You're not like other father," Jaden said.
Denric had almost forgotten the boy was there, as Jinzan so often had with Anzik. He had only one son now, he knew, and he vowed not to make the same mistakes as Jinzan had.
"No," Stalyard said with a smile and a suppressed laugh. "He is not."
"What news from the other side?" Denric asked.
"Rumors, but none of them happy," Stalyard said. "There was a battle so fierce it was felt in the ether even in Gelk. Cadrus and the royal palace are in ruins. Brannis and Roshan Solaran are missing, presumed dead."
"None of that sounds bad to me," Denric joked.
"Lan Mai, as well, was destroyed by Roshan Solaran," Stalyard said.
Denric's face fell. "Jaden, is Anzik well?" he asked the boy. Jaden nodded. Denric breathed a sigh of relief.
"I saved them," Jaden said.
"Saved who?"
"Mother, and Aunt Naka, and Aunt Zeychel, and the new baby, and..."
"They're all alive?" Denric asked. "Everyone survived when Roshan attacked?"
"Well, you were dead and you left anyway, so someone had to. He was too strong, so I just hit us all with my magic."
"I was dead?" Denric asked, catching the curious turn of phrase in Jaden's explanation.
"Well, you were like the dog, dead but still moving. I didn't say anything because I figured you knew it was wrong. I didn't want you to get in trouble."
I was dead, wasn't I?" Denric looked at Jaden, an empty certainty nestling inside him. The loss of Jinzan in his dreams made perfect sense. Jaden nodded. All across northern Kesh, tiny caches were unearthed. Little pockets of wealth and keepsake trinkets were excavated from walls and floors, pried from beneath boulders, and dug up from remote landmarks. The very soil of Kesh was made poorer by the efforts, its hidden treasures stripped from its safekeeping and returned to, in most cases,
someone other than their rightful owner, but in all cases to the same person who had hidden them away, or at least to her twin. Celia loomed over the seated Emperor Somic, fussing with the collar of his regalia. There had been a whole gaggle of servants busying themselves about him, but none had done it the way Celia had wanted. She shooed them all away.
"What if I misspeak some portion of it?" Emperor Somic whispered. "If I offend anyone, we might end up with civil war."
"Nonsense," Celia whispered in reply. "You know the whole plan back to front. No playing the spoiled fop now. It's been nearly a season. If we don't settle things soon, it will be worse than leaving it to chance. Nobles will gobble up unclaimed lands and hold them like miser's coin."
"Yes, but the finer points, the names, the cities, the names," Emperor Somic said. His gaze drifted.
Celia took Emperor Somic's face between her two hands and turned him to look up into her eyes. It was hard enough holding the man's attention when she was not wearing a low-cut gown, but she had that to deal with as well.
"Listen to me. If you want me to handle this, I will. Is that what you want?" she asked.
A pleading look answered her before any words were spoken.
"Yes," Emperor Somic answered. "Fine. That means I go out first," Celia said.
Emperor Somic nodded. She patted him on the cheek, checked to make sure she had not mussed his hair, and set the crown a trifle straighter atop his skull. Celia snapped her fingers, and an attendant took the signal that they were ready. Celia walked out into the audience chamber, a portion of the palace that had not been reduced to rubble and scorched rock by Kyrus and Rashan's battle. Varna saw them approach and gave a tiny frown. Celia's subtle hardening of her glare was all the counter-argument it took for the guard captain to understand.
"May I present Her Highness, Empress Celia, and His Highness, Emperor Somic, first of his name," Varnas called out.
Everyone in the audience hall fell to a knee, save two: Varnas himself, and Exterion, who by common accord would involve himself in no activity likely to kill a man of 142 summers' age. This category included unnecessary bending, kneeling, and hurrying of any sort. He gave a curt nod as a stand-in. Celia sat down in the higher of the two thrones. She was clad in a scarlet gown that dipped low around the neck and stretched tight across her stomach.
It was intended to accentuate, not hide, the early signs that she was carrying the imperial heir.
The crown on her head matched Emperor Somic's in style, but with gentler curves and less prominent jewels. It also fit far more comfortably on her head, and not for reasons of size or shape. The aftermath of the first attempt at an imperial wedding left the governance of the empire in shambles. Celia's quick thinking had not only saved the emperor, it had left her as one of the few in any position to wed him. Somic had lobbied for a sorceress bride initially, and with all who had objected now removed, he had taken Celia as both empress and confidant. No longer did he have the vague threats and hints of advisors leading him by the leash. Instead, he had a proper wife to do it, her motives at least commingling with his own. The list of petitioners in Varnas's hand dangled from shoulder to floor. Each had their turn before Empress Celia, though most had come expecting the more jovial Somic to hear their entreaties. Noble succession, inheritance, transfers of debt and lien, petitions for reparations, pleas for aid in rebuilding this ruined city or that burned-out village. Celia heard them all and passed judgment. All her decisions had been made in advance. Written petitions had been submitted prior to the audience. Somic knew and agreed with all of her pronouncements, and had even memorized them as best he could. Celia had been willing to let him sit in the high throne and act the proper emperor, but she was seeing more each day that he was going to defer to her.
"Such power I now wield. The Kadrin Empire is a gutted shell, but I can oversee its rebirth."
Part of that rebirth involved the apportionment of unclaimed lands, lands whose noble custodians had been wiped out by Kyrus and Rashan.
"Brannis, I must remember."
Celia knew that Brannis was alive and well in some other world. Kyrus, if he lived,
was the murderous traitor.
"Next petitioner is Sir Todd Hellet," Varnas announced. Todd stepped forward and knelt to the royal couple. He was wearing a doublet bearing the Hellet family crest, a recent invention to be certain. It depicted a golden owl on a purple diamond. Ostensibly, the owl was a sign of wisdom, but more accurately, it was a silent, nocturnal predator. He had a sword at his hip, of the kind an aspiring noble would be expected to carry. It was jeweled and lightweight, fit only for dueling an unarmored opponent or for wearing as decoration.
"Sir Todd, you are granted hereditary rights to Reaver's Crossing and the surrounding lands," Empress Celia proclaimed. "In keeping with the standing of this holding, you are awarded the title of Lord Hellet. Your services to the Kadrin Empire are well documented in Warlock Rashan's records, though no official acknowledgement was granted at the time. Know now that Lord Hellet was assigned to perform crucial acts of reconnaissance and sabotage within the borders of Magrin during the recent war."
"Thank you, Your Highness," Todd replied, accepting his ennoblement just as he had been coached, even managing to suppress his peasant patois for all four words.
"As you are aware," Empress Celia continued, "the city of Reaver's Crossing has fallen to Magrin hands and must be reclaimed as part of the Empire before you may take residence. The conquest and rebuilding efforts fall to you."
"Yes, Your Highness. Thank you, Your Highness."
Todd stood and saluted. Then, with a turn and a fox's grin, walked back among the crowd to listen to the rest of the petitions. Petty matters had been swept clear of the proceedings. All that were left were gifts and promotions.
"Next petitioner is Sir Jodul Brecht," Varnas announced.
Jodul presented himself in livery he had designed, despite numerous advisory objections during the process. It was arranged in a box pattern, the upper left and lower right quadrants bearing a pair of dice, showing 6 and 1. The upper right bore a gold coin, and the lower left a skull. If one was tempted to think that Jodul may have intended to use his elevated station to make a better man of himself, one was a fool, ignorant of both the man and nobles in general.
"Sir Jodul, you are granted hereditary rights to Mune and the surrounding lands,"
Empress Celia announced.
"In keeping with the standing of this holding, you are awarded the title of Lord Brecht. Your service to the Kadrin Empire coincided with that of Lord Hellet, and you served with equal distinction. Many battles were won that otherwise we may have lost, based on the intelligence you gathered."
"Thanks, Highness," Jodul replied, giving the Empress a wink.
Celia set her jaw and pretended not to notice.
"The city of Mune suffered greatly under the Magrin occupation.
The task of restoring it to its prior greatness falls to you," Empress Celia said.
"Won't be a problem, Empress Celia," Jodul assured her. "I know a thing or two about how cities run. I'll have her back in whistling the fishwife's welcome again in a summer or two."
Celia was less than familiar with tavern songs, but did not appreciate the gist of the illusion. The idea had been to fill the noble ranks with biddable fools who had plausible ties to Warlock Rashan's hidden schemes. Celia had taken many of the warlock's notes herself, so forging false heroics had been an act of an afternoon's scribbling. When Lord Brecht was cleared from the audience chamber, she proceeded to bestow the city of Risler to the newly ennobled Lord Aelon Beff, and Illard's Glen to Lord Sanbin Colvern. She had considered commissioning the Dragonsmith as an imperial armorer and swordsmith, but he served her better as a lord than a small pile of ruined blades ever would. The final pronouncement to the audience was not hers to give. She nodded to Captain Varnas.
"High Sorcerer Axterion Solaran, if you would step forward, please," Varnas announced. "This final decree is your domain."
"Aye, indeed," Axterion grumbled in reply.
His steps came haltingly, aided by a silver-tipped cane. It was not so much that he needed the aid, but rather that he spent more time on his feet of late, and preferred to spread the aches out, rather than hoard them all in his lower joints. When he had ascended to stand next to the imperial thrones, Axterion swept the chamber with a roomy gaze, as much for show as anything since his eyes saw little. He looked more his part as High Sorcerer than Celia thought she did as Empress.
He had not held a position since before she was born, but he knew it backward and front.
"Today's final petitioner is Danilasis Soloran," Varnas called out.
Curious mutters pervaded the hall. Rumors about the boy warlock had spread through Cadrus and much of the Southern Empire. With Warlock Rashan's disappearance, there was great comfort in the fact that there might be an heir to the Empire's defense,
when so much of the world had so recently sought their destruction.
Danilasis wore all black, in the style of the Imperial Circle that he had yet to officially join. Across his back was the sheathed sleeping dragon, as tall as he was. There had been attempts by various adult sorcerers to reclaim the blade from him, but none was willing to go so far as to try to take it from him by force. Danilasis walked up and stood at the base of the steps to the thrones. He stared up, glancing back and forth between Empress Celia and Exterion, sparing just a quick sidelong look at Emperor Somek. Celia noticed Exterion waggling his eyebrows furiously at the boy and giving stern glances toward the floor. But the boy persisted in standing, either oblivious or willful.
"Hi, sorcerer," Celia prompted, too weary from the long audience to prolong it over protocol in regards to a boy of 8 summers.
Exterion cleared his throat.
"Danilasis Soloran, you have shown both power and valor in your service to the Empire. You have proven to the satisfaction of both General Shadreason and myself that you are capable of handling the mental rigors of magical battle. As such, you are acknowledged as a provisional warlock of the Empire."
"Provisional? What's that mean?" Danilasis asked, his little brow knit in a mixture of consternation and the sense that he had just been denied the proper title of warlock.
"It means that while you have the power and nervous fortitude to be warlock one day, you lack wisdom and experience. Your rashness in securing your own ship was excused only in so much as you were so successful with it. I cannot condone a warlock acting on such rash impulses with regularity," Exterion explained,
his tone borrowed from high sorcerers 1,000 winters dead, and handed down one to the next ever since.
"But when will I—" "You will attend the academy, as you were always meant to. There you will learn the finer details of magic, to fill in the gaps between your rather disturbing adeptness with spells that a lad twice your age should never have learned a word of. You will participate in ranking day, starting with your first year, and you will be paired against the winner of each age in turn. Your title of provisional warlock will be contingent on coming out atop the rankings each year." "Hey, that's not—" "No, it's not fair," Exterion said. "You can go about killing men thrice your age, and stand against sorcerers 8-fold your age. But I will not put the safety of the Cadran Empire at the whim of an overly incautious boy, no matter his talent. Warlocks died young, as a rule, and we have just seen what became of the exception. If I have my say, you will walk a better path." "Dismissed," Exterion said, an edge in his voice brooking no argument.
Even Celia, sitting safely outside his gaze, felt a shudder through her. The ancient sorcerer wrapped authority around him like an old cloak, the sort with dried reddish stains belonging to old foes. There was an island in the southern part of Kesh that few visited. It was a little sliver of land in the middle of a lake that looked like the slit in a dragon's eye, or a cat's if your civilization was the sort that thought dragons were mere myth. Too small to settle and devoid of mineral riches, it was given over to the trees. Hidden among those trees was a pair of stone markers, carved of granite, adorned with runes that would outlast mountains. Upon those markers, side by side, were carved 2 simple inscriptions. Brennus, Soria. There was no force on Tellurak that could disturb either the markers or the bodies laid to rest beneath them, nor would there be, unless the ancient gods returned. Iliardra sat in her home, lost in thought, eyes and her sense of the ether closed. The universe had been disturbed. Seasons would not be long enough to calm the sense of unease she felt since the final clash between Kyrus and Rashan. The mortal's decision to tempt fate in the deep ether rather than accept his loss had shaken her. She should have foreseen the possibility,
It was such a slim hope, to trade at least 200 summers' life ahead for the faintest whisper of a chance at immortality. He had so much to live for.
"So it's over," a voice called, snapping Iliardra from her reveries.
She looked up and saw a face she had never expected to see again. Coal-black skin and a gleaming smile looked back at her. He looked Safshan, but was not. He predated the founding of that land, and most of the various kingdoms, empires, and city-states that had preceded it.
"I suppose patience prevails once more."
"Bavatrain!"
Iliardra exclaimed.
"I thought you were dead."
Few things could surprise her, she thought, but fate had just delivered a dissenting opinion.
"Of course you did," Bavatrain replied, smirking.
He eased himself down into a seat next to Iliardra and put an arm around her. Iliardra was having no such half measure and threw her arms around the demon. She wept openly onto his chest.
"Roshan killed you. We were convinced, but could not prove it," Iliardra said, voice trembling.
"He would have, I was convinced," Bavatrain replied. "But I was not willing to get myself killed to prove it."
He pulled Iliardra close and stroked her long ears, smoothed her wild hair.
"Did Zizix know?"
Iliardra asked. She was ready to be furious with the reclusive ruler of Azat.
"No. No, I merely seeded his thoughts with my concerns over Roshan and his jealousy. I could trust no one with the secret until Roshan was dead," Bavatrain replied. "Can you forgive me?"
Iliardra said nothing, but her lips reached up for his, and she pulled him down atop her.